When you think of an art heist, you might imagine a museum closed for the night. A shadowy figure slinks through the room, outsmarting the high-tech security system and getting away with a giant diamond or a famous painting. So it might surprise you to know that a lot of stolen art and artifacts are actually already in museums, and they have been for a long time.
Yes, sir.
Only plan.
My soul, my baby.
This is Native community members welcoming people into the exhibit hall in their different Native languages.
Chip Caldwell is the senior curator of anthropology at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science.
This is the Tlingit language.
During a tour of the museum's North American Indian Cultures Hall, we come to a surprising sight in one of the display cases.
Okay, so we have a spot here that's got two empty hooks. What's going on there?
Yeah, so that's intentional.
When Caldwell arrived at the museum in 2007, he wondered the same thing.
It turned out that the museum had just repatriated a really, really sacred object. It's what's called a Gon mask. A Gon is a mountain spirit to the Apache people.
The museum received it as a donation. The donors got it from an antiquities dealer.
I have a quote here from one of the letters that he sent to the person who bought it in 1964.
The dealer, well, he hadn't exactly gotten it reputably.
If we don't have it, we can get it. There are certain ceremonial items, which, for obvious reasons, we prefer not to discuss in an open letter like this. But we will write about these in a personal letter, if so requested. So the collector knew he was dealing with very sensitive materials that he probably shouldn't have been trading in, and yet he was.
The mask is one of thousands of culturally sacred objects, including human remains and funerary items, that the museum has returned over the past 30 years as part of the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA. When it was passed, Caldwell says a lot of curators feared the federal law would mean the end of museums, that they'd be emptied out. The anthropology department's huge archival space, lined with two-story high shelves so heavy they have to be moved through a crank system, prove that didn't happen. There are still about 80,000 items in the museum's collection, including a fish trap from the Tilawa tribe in California.
You can see it's this really kind of intricately woven box where you place it in the water and fish swim in, they're trapped, and you got a nice, easy dinner.
Once, during a tour with a group of Tilawa elders, Caldwell says one of them spotted it.
We had the cabinet open, and he walked by, and he goes, "Oh, you know, I think I know the maker of this one." We're like, "Who's that?" He's like, "Me." And so we looked on our records, and sure enough, he was the maker. We actually had his name in our records.
Turns out he'd made it for a friend 40 years ago. The friend sold it, and eventually it was donated to the museum.
Before this 1990 federal law NAGPRA came into place, it was pretty rare for Native peoples to come into museums to form collegial relationships with curators. But because of this law, for the first time, many Native peoples and many museum people had to talk and work together.
These new relationships also bring tribal members to the table in the design of exhibitions, such as History Colorado's Written on the Land, Ute Voices, Ute History exhibit.
We refer to ourselves as Nuchu, the people. Nuchu is in Ute means the people.
Ernest House Jr. is former director of the Colorado Commission of Indian Affairs and a member of the Ute Mountain Ute tribe, which helped to curate the exhibit. He says it was important not only to show their past, but also their future.
Tribes definitely didn't want these pictures of you see the black and white photographs, but that's where so much of American history is, unfortunately, where it stops. That a general population believes that American Indians are from the past, something in the distant, no longer here today.
In some ways, House says NAGPRA is like this exhibition, focused on reclaiming historical items, but heavily impacting the way museums and Native tribes work together going forward.
Who better to talk to than who you're talking about, who are in these exhibits, who are still here, who still have this language, and at the same time, this indigenous community that needs help with ways to expand that conversation.
But even after 30 years, there are still lots of items that have not been returned. Both tribal members and museum officials agree the process is just not that simple. Isabel Tovar is History Colorado's NAGPRA liaison and assistant curator of archaeology and ethnography. She says it takes time to undo what began in the 1800s,
There was essentially a race on to see who was going to get the best collection of fill in the blank. And so oftentimes communities had no idea, most times communities had no idea where their material and their ancestors had ended up.
There's also the sheer volume of items. History Colorado, for example, has almost 6,000 items in its Native American collection, even after returning all of its human remains and funerary objects.
And so I always say this, that we know of. Oftentimes you'll hear that people say, you know, you can finish your NAGPRA compliance and all that. It's never really done. There's always more.
Colorado has also been a leader in closing some of NAGPRA's loopholes. The state was the first to establish a protocol to address inadvertently discovered Native American remains and funerary objects found on state and private lands, as well as returning culturally unidentifiable individuals in a more timely manner. Ernest House Jr. says that was essential to beginning the process of bringing together more than 45 tribal nations that once called Colorado home, and it's something that more states need to look at.
Now you have either extractive industry or oil and gas or whatever it might be around looking at digging in certain areas around that state. Maybe there's a build out of certain homes. You know, again, trying to educate people that there was indigenous cultures here long before there was any corridors, I-25 corridor, I-70, or roads over different passes.
Back at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, curator Chip Caldwell shows me an unassuming door at the very back of the archive room. It's locked, and only two people have the keys. Caldwell is one, but he says we can't go inside.
One thing that Native peoples ask us over and over again is to ensure that these items, whether they're truly sacred or not, be sequestered, set aside, not bothered.
So here these 1,000 items will stay, in a sort of limbo, waiting for a tribal member to come retrieve them. Unfortunately, some may never be returned.
To know that you have something that perhaps was stolen, and that perhaps someone wants back, but maybe they can't get back, is a huge burden.
But Caldwell says it's one that museums need to carry, in an effort to right the wrongs of the past.
Museum people, they were doing their best to try to preserve and protect cultures, but they were focused on the object. Today, when we think about preserving, protecting cultures, we think about the people. What do the people need, not just the object themselves? And sometimes the people today need the object to ensure that their culture survives.
Stacy Nick, KUNC.